This is Michael Shannon, your volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and this is Arizona History. In my readings, we'll focus mainly on the events and characters that shaped our Arizona history and culture. Today, I want to tell you about a prospector named Ed Schifflin and how the town of Tombstone got its name. Also, if time allows, we'll check in with Arizona's historian and True West Magazine writer and contributor, Marshall Trimble. Ed Schifflin was an American prospector and Indian scout who discovered silver in the Arizona Territory, an event that led to the founding of Tombstone. He entered into a partnership with his brother Al and mining engineer Richard Gird in a handshake deal that produced millions of dollars of wealth for all three men. During the course of Tombstone's mining history, about $85 million in silver was produced from its mines. Schifflin was born in a coal mining region of Wellsboro, Pennsylvania, the son of a prominent New York and Pennsylvania family, in 1847. Schifflin's father, Clinton Emmanuel Del Palo Schifflin, settled in the Rogue Valley, Oregon Territory, in the mid-1850s to raise cattle, grain, and children. The family maintained an interest in the mining activities in the area. At age 17, Schifflin set out on his own as a prospector and miner. He began looking for gold and silver in about 1865. From Oregon, he went east to Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, then searched across Nevada into Death Valley, back into Colorado, and then New Mexico. A year later, Schifflin moved to California to find gold. He surveyed the Grand Canyon area as well. Unsuccessful, he heard that a group of Halopai Indians had enlisted as scouts for the United States Army, which was establishing a camp to counter the Chiricahua Apache threat and to secure the nearby border with Mexico. The Army established Camp Huachaca at the foot of the Huachaca Mountains in Pima County, Arizona Territory, on March 3, 1877. Silver had already been discovered in some northern areas of Arizona Territory, but the southern portion had been under continued Apache attack. Schifflin accompanied the Camp Huachaca scouts on a few trips into the backcountry while prospecting part-time. He finally decided to stay put and explore the hills full-time. The hills east of the San Pedro River where he prospected could be dangerous. They were only about 12 miles from the hostile Chiricahua Apache Indians led by Cochise, Geronimo, and Victoria that had established a stronghold in the Dragoon Mountains. Frederick Brunkow, a Prussian-born mining engineer, discovered silver in the hills of Cochise County in 1858. He built a cabin near the San Pedro River after finding a small silver deposit nearby. He hired three other white men and about a dozen Mexican miners. In September 1860, two of the white men were robbed and murdered at the cabin, and Brunkow was found dead in the mine with a rock drill through him. The German cook blamed the Mexican workers for the murders. After Brunkow's death, ongoing conflict with the native Indians prevented further development of the mines for several years. Brunkow's San Pedro mine influenced Ed Schifflin to prospect the rocky outcropping northeast of the cabin. In 1876, Schifflin and his party were attacked by Apaches, and a man named Lennox was killed. The cabin was the site of 22 murders during the frontier days. When friend and fellow Army Scout Al Sieber learned what Schifflin was up to, he is quoted as telling him, "The only rock you will find out there will be your own tombstone." Other accounts reported Shifflin's friends told him, "Better take your coffin with you. You will find your tombstone there and nothing else." He searched the gullies and washes, always looking for the proof of his hunch. His hunch that this area would be filled with the riches of silver for him to locate. He had not found any impressive-looking ore, but he wouldn't let go. He kept on, working into more dangerous areas as he drew nearer to the Dragoon Mountains, the hideout of the Apaches, and finally found some float ore, which looked good. Had his float ore or chunks of ore come from a deposit that had perhaps been washed away from the motherlode miles away? Ed painstakingly traced this float to the ledge from which it came. He found the source. The source being a vein of silver. Riches, yes, that is what Ed had found. Riches of silverstone. Ed Shefflin had found his tombstone. After many years of searching, Ed was now just 29 years old and flat broke. How would he manage to not only stake his claim, but also venture into Tucson to have it assayed? He shared this vision with a man named William Griffith, who promised to pay for the recording of anything Ed found in return for a claim of his own. Griffith was the man who actually recorded the tombstone claim on September 3, 1877. However, Tucson did not have an assay office, and the men to whom Griffith and Ed showed their ore to were of the belief that the sample was worthless. It was at this time that Griffith severed his connection with this venture, going into ranching hoping for a better investment for his money. Ed now had to venture on without a backer. No matter what anyone else would have to say on this matter, Ed knew that silver was out there. He had a hunch. With only 30 cents in his pocket, he decided to head north to Globe, Arizona, to seek out his brother Al, who worked at the Silver King Mine. However, Al was no longer at the Silver King Mine in Globe, but had ventured on to the McCracken Mine in Signal City. Ed was flat broke at this time, as he had spent 30 cents on tobacco and found it necessary to work in the mine himself before he would be able to travel west to Signal City and meet up with his brother Al. Ed worked as a night operator of the hoist at a silver mine and hauled up dozens of tons of ore every night by cranking a hand windlass. This was backbreaking work, but necessary to fund his search for his brother Al and perhaps his hunch. Having earned enough money, he left for Signal City and finally found his brother there. This is where Ed met up with Richard Gird. Gird was the assayer at the McCracken Mine and assayed the ore at $2,000 a ton. Was the hunch paying off? A partnership was slated and hands shook by the three, and off to the hills of the tombstone mine they went, with Gird supplying a mule, a wagon, his assay equipment, his experience, and connections to what would become known as the richest mining camp in the country. Mines sprung along this area known as Goose Flats. Mines such as the Lucky Cuss, the Tough Nut, and the Contention were soon to be assayed around $15,000 to the ton. Ed Shifflin found the mother lode, and Gird's investigations showed that the ore veins ran deep. Soon the area would be thronged with prospectors all wanting their share of the riches as word of the bonanza spread. There was now a need for a town. The town at Goose Flats, a mesa overlooking the Tough Nut claim, was a superb location. The town site company was formed, and in March of 1879, Solon M. Ellis laid out the town. The town known today as Tombstone, the name chosen by Ed Shifflin as a sly nod to his earlier detractors. On March 13, 1879, Al and Ed Shefflin sold their two-thirds interest in the Tombstone Mining and Milling Company, which owned the Tuffnut Mine, for $1 million each to the Corbin brothers, Hamilton Diston of Philadelphia and Simmons Squire of Boston. Safford became president of the new Tombstone Gold and Silver Mining and Milling Company with Richard Gird as superintendent. Ed moved on, but Al remained in Tombstone for some time longer. Gird later sold off his one-third interest for $1 million, doubling what the Shefflins had been paid. Gird remained in the territory, but Ed Shefflin left to pursue other interests. Ed Shefflin was now a millionaire and wanted to set out and see the world. His journeys took him north, not dressed as he was when he found his tombstone, but in the finest of the day. He married Mary Brown, whom he had met in San Francisco, and settled in Los Angeles, where they lived with his brother Al. When Poochees County was formed in February 1881, Tombstone became the county seat. In 1881, early in Tombstone's rapid growth, Ed's brother Al built Shefflin Hall as a theater, a recital hall, and a meeting place for Tombstone citizens. His grandniece, Mary Shefflin Brady, reopened it in 1964, and it remains an attraction in Tombstone. It is the largest standing adobe structure in the Southwest United States and is still located on Fremont Street and still holds events for the residents of Tombstone. At its height in the mid-1880s, Tombstone's population was officially about 7,000 miners, but some estimates figure in an additional 5,000 to 7,000 women and children, Chinese, Mexicans, and prostitutes. In the late 1880s, the silver mines reached the water table, and the mines eventually filled with water. Tombstone's population faded until tourism became its main attraction. Al had died in 1885 of consumption, but later, longing for the solitude of the wilderness, Ed left the riches and finery and headed for a cabin in Oregon prospect again. In 1897, Shefflin bought a ranch near his brothers Effingham and Jacob outside Woodville, now Rogue River, Oregon. He continued prospecting in the Canyonville area where he searched for gold and silver. On May 12, 1897, after he had not shown up in town for supplies for several days, his neighbor checked on him and found him face down on the floor of his miner's cabin. The coroner ruled that he had died of a heart attack. The ore samples found in his cabin were later reported to have assayed at more than $2,000 to the ton. Other reports from his family said it was only valued at $7 per ton. Shefflin did not leave a map or directions behind, pointing to the origins of his new discovery. The last entry in this journal simply read, "Struck it rich again, by God." He was initially buried near his cabin about 20 miles east of Canyonville. It was shortly afterwards he learned that he had requested to be buried in Tombstone. "It is my wish, if convenient, to be buried in the dress of a prospector, my old pick and canteen with me, on top of the Granite Hills, about 3 miles westerly from the city of Tombstone, Arizona, and that a monument such as prospectors build when locating a mining claim to be built over my grave." Shefflin was interred about 3 miles northwest of Tombstone, Arizona, near the dry wash in which he originally found silver ore and the later location of the Grand Central Mine. He was buried as his will specified, in mining clothes with pick, shovel, and his old canteen. He didn't crave fame. He just loved prospecting. The silence of his grave on a hill in Tombstone fits the kind of man he was. And so it is today that you will find the monument to Tombstone's founder at Shifflin, located near where he did prove his hunch true, a monument having been erected in his honor, stating simply, "Ed Shifflin died May 12, 1897, aged 49 years, 8 months, a dutiful son, a faithful husband, a kind brother, and a true friend." He divided his estate between his wife and his brother Jay. "I give my wife, Mary E. Shifflin, all interests, both real and personal properties, in Alameda and Santa Clara Counties, California. Also 15 $1,000 University of Arizona bonds. All other properties, both real and personal, I give to my brother, J. L. Shifflin." Mary Shifflin moved to New York City after her husband's death. As the history of the American West was being made, individuals and places became famous. Today, the mere reference to these names conjures up images of legendary people and towns of the Old West in the minds of people all over the world. There is one place that still grabs our imagination and interest today, Tombstone, Arizona. It was Ed Shifflin's discovery of silver in the hills of southeastern Arizona Territory that made this place an American legend. Without his courage, tenacity, and vision, the area known as Tombstone would still be called Goose Flats. Tombstone, Arizona has never been the wild, gun-toting, shoot-em-up place it has been made out to be. It was a very modern, sophisticated, and extremely wealthy town. Telephones were installed in Tombstone in 1882. By 1883, the city had 2 gas companies, 3 water companies, 2 ice companies, 5 ice cream parlors. Fresh seafood was delivered daily from Baja, Mexico. West of the city was a track for horse racing, and on the infield of the racetrack was a baseball diamond. Tombstone had a baseball team from 1882 to 1929. The first swimming pool in Arizona Territory was built at the north end of 5th Street. The mining camp became a metropolis that rivaled San Francisco, California. I hope that you enjoyed learning about Ed Shifflin and the beginnings of the town of Tombstone. In fact, the beginnings of one of Arizona's major industries, the mining of precious and industrial metals. Now let's check in with Arizona's historian Marshall Trimble, a columnist for True West magazine. In the August 2009 edition, Marshall answers several questions that readers have posted to True West magazine's column, Ask the Marshall. The first question was sent in by Jim Catalano of San Ramon, California. Jim asks, "Were the Spanish vaqueros the first to round up and herd cattle in the West?" Marshall Trimble answers, "Our fearless leader, Bob Bozbell, responds, the Spanish were rounding up cattle from horse track several hundred years before the American cowboy made an appearance. It's really an incredible story with layers and layers of expertise in terms of horses training and roping methods. It is a story that is long overdue, and most Americans don't know that the vaquero was the true master of the art long before the cowboy. I might add that the term buckaroo is an American corruption of vaquero. The Spanish really set the foundation for cowboying in this country. The American cowpuncher was quite innovative and resourceful, but wherever they swing a rope, wear a wide-brimmed hat, high-heeled boots, spurs, chaps, or hold a rodeo, they are paying tribute to the vaquero." The next question is sent in by Ted Mulligan of Massapequa, New York. He asks, Did outlaws prefer Spanish Mustangs? Marshall answers, I wouldn't call them the first choice. Outlaws wanted to ride the fastest horse money could buy, or they could steal. A Spanish Mustang might be good in country that required stamina and durability, but it generally was not fast enough to make a getaway in flat, open country. Jesse James was known to be fond of fast horses, either quarter horses or thoroughbreds. He raced them and he rode them in his criminal enterprises. During the James Younger foray into Minnesota in 1876, the gang came riding in on the finest animals the townsfolk had ever seen. This aroused suspicion. As a result, the Northfield residents kept a close eye on the heavily armed strangers. Yet those fast horses didn't do the outlaws much good after the raid. The animals were ridden in tough terrain to the point of exhaustion and later had to be abandoned. The next question is sent in by Larry Dye of Fenton, Illinois. Larry asks, I have often heard about the Code of the West. Was there, in fact, a list of rules for conduct in the Old West? According to Marshall Trimble, no Code of the West exists per se, but an ethic did develop on the frontier that came to define American character. Several traits were necessary for survival on the frontier. A man's word is his bond, self-reliance, trust, hard work, honesty, perseverance, dependability, and independence. These rules weren't posted anywhere, but were known by many. Later, when the Old West faded from reality into myths, books like Owen Wister's The Virginian and the silver screen stars like Tom Mix, Buck Jones, Roy Rogers, Gene Autry, and Hopalong Cassidy introduced us to their interpretation of the Code of the West. I think the Code was wonderful because it provided a moral standard for millions of youngsters who grew up believing those time-honored values. The next question is sent in by Ron Vermillion of Chattanooga, Tennessee. Ron asks, did Indians have a smoke Morse code that sent messages, or were the smoke signals a confirmation of a prearranged plan? Marshall answers, unlike sign language, which has a standardized code, smoke signals aimed to send a secret message, usually some sort of prearranged code, since the smoke signals could be visible to both friend and foe. Yet some basic signals were used. For example, one puff meant attention, two puffs meant all's well, three puffs meant danger or help. The number three is pretty universal even today with hunters, outdoorsmen, and Boy Scouts when one is signaling for help. Usually this would be whistling three times, firing three shots, or even three puffs from a fire to signal help. Next question is sent in by Susan Short of Rothbury, Michigan. My husband and I have noticed that some of the big stars rode the same horses in a lot of their movies. Were these their own mounts or did the film companies supply them? Marshall Trimble answers, most people know that Roy Rogers rode Trigger, Gene Autry rode Champion, Rex Allen rode Coco, and Tom Mix rode Tony. In all of these cases, the actors owned their trusty steeds. Some studios did require that actors provide their own horses. Yet you may not know the favorite horses of actors like John Wayne, Old Dollar, Randolph Scott, Stardust, and James Stewart, Pie. Sometimes an actor grew attached to the horse he was riding in the film and bought it from the owner. In other cases, like Jimmy Stewart, he required that the studio provide a specific horse for a movie. The Duke's production company bought Old Dollar and used him from True Grit to The Shootist, Wayne's last film. The next question is sent in by Bill Chillicote of Yakima, Washington. what happened to the corpses of guys killed in running gunfights in the Old West. Marshall says, if possible, those close to the deceased would bury the bodies in a shallow grave. If they were burying a friend or ally, they would cover the grave with heavy rocks so wild animals wouldn't come along and dig up the remains. If the gravesite was in hostile Indian country, they would camouflage the grave as best as they could so the bodies would not be disturbed. If they were in a desperate situation and had to save their own hides, they had no choice but to leave the bodies where they fell. When gunfighters bit the dust, anything valuable on the persons was taken off the bodies. If nobody had time to check, sometimes the killers just left the valuables where they lay. Several years ago, I found one such valuable, a rusted old conversion pistol on the Santa Fe Trail in New Mexico. This is Michael Shannon, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and this has been a reading of Arizona history. I hope you found our stories interesting. This is Michael Shannon, your Sun Sounds reader, and we'll have more stories for you the next time we meet. You missed a program, you can get it on demand at the Sun Sounds website, www.sunsounds.org. Click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Scroll down to the programming links and choose On Demand Broadcasts. Sun Sounds is also available on your smart home device.